Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for practicing attorney, Miss Kelly O'Connell. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It was exciting to be here.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you. You are the first person from the legal profession of any way, form, fashion, scope.
Oh, boy.
That's been here. So it's very cool. And a little bit of self-disclosure. I was one of those kids that when I was growing up, everyone told me I was supposed to be an attorney.
Did you like to argue?
Maybe.
That's usually the common trait, but I was guilty of it too.
So I guess then that's a good place to start off. Take me back to when it starts to hit you that you want to be involved in something like this. What skill was it that you started to see in yourself or other people started to see in you that led you down this road to begin with?
Yeah, I was actually, going right into it. I was a weird 7-year-old that wanted to be a criminal defense attorney.
Oh, wow.
That was my big dream, and I made it work, but it was actually, I had a lot of personal experiences. Obviously, I was a 7-year-old committing crimes, but
right.
I knew individuals when I was around that time frame that had interactions with the criminal justice system, and it started out with what we feel was wrongful convictions and just seeing the effect on the not only that individual but the people around them and how much it not only affects them but every aspect around them and the people. And so at 7, I was like, let me talk to the judge at their sentencing hearing, and they're like, no, like, Kelly, please sit down. Which now I would have loved to know what 7-year-old me would have said to a judge at a sentencing hearing. But it started out as that. And then as I grew older, I saw various facets of the criminal justice system and how what started out as innocent people wrongly going through it and how they can be convicted to the other end of it, where there's people that are very much guilty and they seem to get away scot-free. And so the concept of it always started to interest me, and I went to college for criminology and criminal justice, and I got into law school, and it just kept going and going and going until eventually I passed the bar exam and started working. I'm like, all right, we're still here.
Well, what do you think? Was it really just a matter of, like, something seemed to be going on that you felt was, like, immoral or some kind of imbalance that you just couldn't reconcile?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was the injustice of it and how unfair the system can be, certainly sometimes. And just, I think 7-year-old me didn't realize it at the time, but just how much goes into it. And certainly that I've seen over the course of my practice now, even that there's a lot of reasons why people commit crimes. And factors that go into it that oftentimes aren't accounted for in the criminal justice system. And so seeing from a young age from that, I think at that point, just seeing the impact that it had on our lives and how it affected not only them, but everyone around them and having to go visit someone in jail, stuff like that, it certainly is an impactful event for a child.
Right.
Also just growing up and learning the realities of it and how the system works and unfortunately the stigmas that they've had to fight the rest of their life with going through that. And so it's been certainly an eye-opening experience that I was like, I just want to fight for people and explain kind of while the laws may be black and white, it's not always black and white. And I like to believe the good in humanity.
Very interesting. So as you're kind of having all of these feelings and you're in high school and you've got this road you want to be traveling, what are you thinking about at that point? I know, you know, you jumped right in to your higher education and you moved there pretty quickly, yeah?
Yeah. I guess in high school, high school was a weird time. did dance. I was a cheerleader, but I was also friends with a wider range of people. And I certainly got to see a little bit of everything and probably did a lot of things that luckily the town I grew up in and with my parents, I probably could have ended up with criminal charges. Luckily, thank God I didn't. But it wasn't in high school, obviously, throughout my entire life, I've said I want to be a criminal defense attorney.
Right.
I wouldn't say I was actively pursuing it in high school. I was getting good grades. I have an Asian mother, so it was required of me to do well in school and succeed and do all those things. But it wasn't really until college when I started learning more from the academic standpoint about like criminology and criminal justice and the way our system works. On a more neutral standpoint to give me more of a background and understanding of things than just the personal experiences I had had. And so it was more so in college that I really started learning more and interning with the public defender's office that I graduated from college early and I went right into law school and decided to work full time while in law school, which wasn't easy, but I think it worked out long term overall.
Right. So when you first get into school, what are some of the things that you started to learn that were from the other side of the coin that were a little bit contrary to your experiences that first started to really open your eyes what this game was really going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because obviously there's a wide spectrum and I see it every day in practice now that laws exist for a reason. Obviously, people do bad things. A lot of the laws and criminal laws were created for a reason and because things have happened. And I certainly have clients that are very much so guilty of what they're charged. And I have other clients that are not. And so it not only, especially in college, it was understanding, yes, these laws exist, but also why do people commit crimes in the first place? Obviously, if there's a wide range of things, and most commonly people think, oh, if someone wants to do something, they will. But a lot of it comes down to someone's, I think nowadays, and with the economy, most of us can understand your socioeconomic status.
I mean,
if it comes down to them being fed and having to eat, are they going to steal food? Then probably so. Does it make it right? No. But can I understand why they did it? Yes. And so there ends up being, it's not for every crime, but for a lot of them, there's reasons why people do things. And it doesn't make them a bad person. It just made them in a bad situation. And maybe they didn't make the best judgment at the time, but it's making sure, too, that the punishment fits the crime and that it doesn't ruin the rest of their life.
So did any of that stuff that you started to learn at that point change what your vision that you had held of being a criminal defense attorney became, or did it just bring it more into focus?
It brought it more into focus. It definitely was hard because when I graduated law school, obviously you have to take the bar exam to become an attorney, and I will be fully transparent to anyone I speak with and saying I did not pass the bar exam on the first try. I didn't even pass it on the second try. Third time's a charm. But it was really scary going through the bar exam at that time because I had never considered another career. I spent my whole life saying I'm going to be this thing. And then I was like, oh, my God, like if I can't pass the bar exam, like what do I do?
Right.
I've never even considered another career. And most people, when they have criminology and criminal justice degrees, they become cops and like, I'd make a terrible cop. One, I'm not running after you. Two, be like, you know, you're right. I could see why you did it. Just go. And they would fire me immediately. So it was certainly hard going through that time period. And there was a few life events that happened as well during the bar exam period. So it was hard knowing, hey, is this really the path that I'm going to pursue? But I think it all worked out and I ended up where I was supposed to be.
That's interesting that you say that. We did have one other guest come on that she's had quite a successful career as a realtor, and she had mentioned it took her three times to pass her test too. And I oftentimes wonder what that's like. And I'd like to ask you, were you having crisis of faith in those moments, or was it just like, hey, I'm coming back round two, round three, I don't care?
Yes, it was hard and certainly questioning if I can do this because, like I mentioned briefly earlier, I worked full time while I was in law school. And the first year I was running a foreclosure mediation program for Hillsborough County. But the second year and beyond, I started working for the firm I'm actually with now. And they do criminal defense and then a few other practice areas as well. But I started working there and going through it all. And I've interacted with a lot of attorneys even before I was an attorney. And you interact with a lot of people in law school and you see people pass the bar exam on their first try that probably aren't always the brightest or the most ethical. And you see attorneys in practice that I'm like, man, like they passed the bar exam. Like, I know I'm smart. I know I work hard. I know I'm passionate about this. Like, what's wrong with me?
And you had a lot of education up to that point.
Yes. And so it's, I think in some ways, working full time kind of bit me and studying for the bar exam because I was like, oh, well, a judge in real life would never do this. And like, ha, ha, ha. It's a bar exam. Like in our world, yes, they would do that. And so it was certainly a mindset shift. And I unfortunately had gone through some traumatic events at that time. And so I had to not only process the trauma and go through therapy of dealing with those, but also learning how to lose and get right back up and persevere and continue on and ask for help. I mean, I had never had a tutor in my life until the bar exam. Which most people, when you're in law school, you're used to being good at everything and
right
to excelling in school and not being the people that usually need tutors. And so the third go around, I finally was like, you know, I have to take a step back from work. I need help. I can't do it with just me. And it's humbling, but I think most of us can acknowledge that there's always a point in which we just got to ask for help sometimes.
Yeah, that's really valuable. And I think that that does become hard for people for sure. Taking that step back. So you take that step back, you put something down so you can pick something up. Good with that philosophy. So what is it like, no pun intended, after you clear the bar?
I have a very fortunate situation that I was only a practicing attorney for a year before I became a partner of a law firm, which is certainly not the normal track. Normally it takes people 5-10 years to go that route. And so it certainly was shocking because you're learning how to be an attorney. I mean, law school, they teach you the theory, they teach you what the laws are, but they never tell you how to be an attorney.
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but what do you mean by that?
So like law school, obviously a lot of it's academic. You're reading all this case law, you're reading all these things, and it's a lot of conceptual stuff, but you pretty much have one class called trial advocacy if you're going to be doing trial work, which I am and certainly was helpful. But it doesn't necessarily teach you negotiation skills or how to be an attorney or how to deal with all these different type of people on an everyday. There's no classes on how to deal with a client that no matter what you do is never going to be good enough. Or when you do everything amazing, you can still lose. And a jury could find your client guilty when you strongly believe that they're innocent. And so the real life practicalness of it is not always taught to you in law school. And so there's constantly learning new things and little exceptions of, oh, this case law and this situation happened. And so actually we can get the whole case thrown out. And they don't always teach you a lot of that in law school. So
gotcha.
You're learning as it is. And then I had the privilege of becoming an attorney a year in, or named partner a year in. And so then I was like, oh my God, no one ever taught me how to run a business either. Like, what am I doing? Like, I don't even do I deserve this? And so there's certainly a lot of imposter syndrome, which I think a lot of us suffer from. And
right.
It certainly ran rampant at that time. But I mean, I think I still suffer from it now. And I think most of us do.
Yeah. It's just a matter of going right foot, left foot when you're in the whole new world type situation.
Yeah. And I think it's good to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it definitely keeps the fire under your feet feeling.
Yes.
Okay. So when you first pass the bar and you get into this practice before you're a named partner, what were you focusing on? Did you start doing criminal defense right away? Is that like your wheelhouse and you'll only do other things if necessary?
So the way our firm is currently situated, we all do all the practice areas.
Oh.
And so even when I worked at our firm in law school as a paralegal and a law clerk, I was handling all of the practice areas. So we do personal injury and consumer protection, class action. So it's given me a very wide range of knowledge, I would say, obviously, from my childhood passion. that I am most passionate about criminal defense, and eventually long-term growth planning wise, I would like to only do criminal defense down the road. But until our firm expands enough to have employees and attorneys that can handle all the different subsections,
right?
I am practicing it all for now.
I think I know what the answer to this is, but I'd like to ask, what is the thing, and I know we already asked this a little bit, but what is the thing about criminal defense that really draws you to it? Because it is, like you said, such a wide range in that you're going to have some clients that are guilty and you know it, and some that aren't, and you got to try to sell a jury that. Like, what's the part of that that makes it more interesting than a class action lawsuit or a personal injury where you're still helping people? It's just...
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it... Glutton for punishment. High stakes, certainly. I mean, people's lives sometimes are literally on the line. But I think a lot of it goes back to the understanding. And I've always been a very empathetic person. And so I think understanding their lives and maybe why they got there. And a lot of people don't have the money for a private attorney,
right.
So they just utilize public defenders, and they end up with criminal history that maybe they shouldn't have had in the first place, or wouldn't have had if they had had the funds and ability to hire an attorney. And having a criminal conviction of any kind will impact your life, especially if it's a felony. And so going in and seeing a lot of my clients have mental health issues. A lot of them have experienced traumas early in their life and suffer from substance abuse issues. I work with a lot of veterans. There's a lot of different reasons and backgrounds that led them to where they are. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the times the criminal justice system and society as a whole, we can look at someone and say, yeah, they were driving drunk. They beat up their wife. They stole this thing. But in the grand scheme of things, yes, they did. But why? What put them in that position that they felt they needed to do that, if they even did it? I mean, obviously, people lie. Plenty of innocent people go through the system as well. But I tend to go to the belief of, if we can fix the root cause of it, then maybe they won't come back and they can change their life for the better. And we won't continue having these problems and we won't see them again. And I think the system often forgets that. They just say, hey, this person did this crime. Let's put them in jail, and we'll hope for the best and hope that they never do that again. And hopefully this punishment will be enough to deter them. And I don't think in reality that that's always the answer for most people.
Yeah, I can see how that yes, of course. But you brought up a good point. If someone is clearly guilty of something, the operative question for you is why. But when you're talking about making a defense for someone, how and when does the why matter?
So it kind of varies on the situation and the client. I mean, sometimes I have clients that say, yeah, I did it. I don't want to go to a trial. I know that they would be able to find me guilty, but I don't think jail is fair or prison is fair. And this is why. This is what I want to work towards. Like with drug possession charges, stuff like that. And so then we look at, okay, well, what is going to help you more long term? Because if we put you in jail, let's be honest, if I had to go to jail or prison, I'd be more likely to continue using drugs as well. It's not a fun place. And so if it means part of my job is seeing, okay, what are our other options available? Let's look at treatment options. Let's get you in a better relationship with your family, that you have a better support system. Let's get you back into school. Let's look at getting you a better job, so that maybe you have more working that, one, we can use it for what we call mitigation to the state to explain, hey, look, yeah, we could send this person to jail, but they're just going to end up back here. Let's fix the problem and give them a better opportunity to not be back here before either of us ever again. And so working with them for more creative solutions.
Do you find that the state's willingness to pursue creative solutions has to be presented to them in a way that it starts as advantageous dollars and cents?
It depends on the county, which it's crazy that I would even say that, but it is shocking how different some of the counties are around here. in their approach for things. Some certainly care more about the dollars and cents. Some don't care at all.
Because it is essentially more cost effective to try to rehabilitate someone and never see them again than it is to indefinitely have them in a incarceration, never ending loop.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to get jaded. Obviously, we're dealing with terrible situations. We see heinous things that people have done, and we see really hard topics. And so it is easy for a lot of the prosecutors and even the judges to look at that and just say, you know what, everyone's bad. Let's just lock them away. We'll put them in jail, and I don't want to deal with it.
Right.
But I think in the long run, it's costing us money for what? The jails are full, the prisons are full, and it's not fixing the behavior. But explaining that to them takes some finesse, because I've certainly explained. So in state court, someone is sentenced according to what they call a score sheet. In federal court, there are guidelines. But essentially, the crime that you're charged with is assigned certain points based on how severe it is. And then if you have any prior criminal history, those are also assigned points. And then it's plugged into an equation, and the number that comes out is how many months you should spend in prison or jail. It is very black and white, and I will never forget, I was in a deposition talking to a victim who was also an attorney. But he did not practice criminal law. And he was like, yes, this person should be sentenced according to their score sheet. So if it says prison, they need to go to prison. And I'm like, okay, well, what do you know about the score sheet? And he's just like, well, that's what the recommended sentence is. And I'm like, yeah, but why? Like, what do you know about it? And he couldn't explain it. And so I explained it to him. And I'm like, yeah, there's points for the crime. There's points for their prior criminal history. Do you see any sections here where there's points or a way to take away points because they have mental health issues, because they were a victim of sexual assault, because they didn't have a job and they didn't have a way to eat and they needed to steal out of a crime of necessity? Are there any reductions for that? No. So is it fair to just sentence them to this number when that number doesn't take into account any other factors? And the prosecutor and this victim are just like, oh. And I'm like, this isn't novel concepts I'm explaining
right,
to people.
Right.
And so a lot of it gets to sentencing. And yes, there's a number that we take into account, but and there's statutory, what we call mitigating factors. But I think beyond it, it's supposed to be more well-rounded. And a lot of times, that's, as a defense attorney, that's part of my job, too, is just explaining, hey, yeah, they scored a this, but let's also take into account all these other factors.
How do you weigh the morality of that? Like, the point system, it sounds almost, and I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but it almost sounds like a joke. Like, you know, it's like, well, you were a good boy up to level 10, but you were a bad boy up to level 15. So now you got to do -5 punishment. You know, how do you weigh those? How do you justify, even within your own head, the morality or the moral weight of any of these things that would justify a greater or lesser punishment for somebody?
I mean, it's hard, and I think I'll probably always suffer from that. And it's frustrating on the defense side because we get clients that, like I said, have criminal history. They have a history. They haven't gotten the opportunities to get treatment, stuff like that. And so when they get a new case, regardless of whether they actually did what they're charged with or not, the state automatically looks at it and is like, well, this is their criminal history. This is what their sentence is. And I'm like, okay, but they didn't do this crime. Just because they did those things in the past doesn't mean that they're guilty of this. And so it can be hard because you feel like you're fighting a losing battle sometimes, which is where the more academic sense of it comes in, of going to trials and fighting the good fight and sometimes relying on the case law of weird little nuances of things that law enforcement might have messed up and can warrant getting the case dismissed. But, I mean, there's such a wide variety of circumstances always that we always tell clients, it depends. It's the most lawyer answer, but, like, it really does. And there's so many factors that go into it.
But ultimately, you have to try to, and this is one thing I've always kind of thought about in my own head. So I'm kind of scratching my own curiosity itch here. If you know someone is guilty, or even if they're just deserving of this level of crime, or this level of punishment rather, at what point do you, at what points do you have to set your morals aside and just know the case law and just be trying to fight for this person regardless of anything you think or feel? When does it become black and white for you, either by necessity or choice?
I mean, I don't know that you ever fully put the morals aside, and that being, I can be completely ethical and maintain my morals of saying and acknowledging and discussing with a client that, yes, you are in fact guilty. There's no disputing it. There's no grounds for me to file a motion to dismiss. The state can prove it if you go to a trial. So what are we going to do about getting you a fair sentence? Making sure that their sentence adequately reflects what they did. If someone stole an apple from Walmart, do they deserve 5 years in prison? Probably not. So it's not always, I think the biggest misconception with criminal defense is that people think that every single case you're shooting for a dismissal, and it's not. I mean, I have a lot of frank conversations with my clients and explain to them why they're wrong and that they are in fact guilty, and a jury would see that. And unfortunately, if they were to take their case to a trial, they'd get a lot harsher sentence. And so there is a benefit to accepting responsibility for what you did. And working out a fair resolution that adequately fits what you did.
That makes sense. I guess the root of this line of questioning for me is, what happens to you when you're presented the opportunity to defend somebody who is guilty as the day is long, and your opinion is, for want of a better way of putting it, fry him, but you still have to get out there and try to make sure they don't get fried?
I mean, if we're going to death penalty, I will never believe in death penalty
speaking hyperbole.
I mean, in some ways, I honestly would prefer a guilty client that I know that it is, because all I'm working on is a fair sentence, whereas the ones that keep me up at night are the innocent ones.
Yeah, and I gather that, but is there ever a time when you feel like the fair sentence is really the whatever the maximum punishment is, and you have to say to yourself, ah, damn it, I have to try to get you not the thing you actually deserve?
Yes, but
because it's the nature of your job.
Yeah, it's my job. Obviously, I'm going to fight for my client and their interests. I have to represent their interests.
Right.
But at the end of the day, if the law doesn't support it, I mean, it's out of my hands, especially on some of these crimes that we represent people all the way from lower level crimes to murders, rapes, stuff like that. And certainly for those cases, the evidence usually supports it. And at the end of the day, I'm going to make sure that nothing weird is done, that no one's infringed on their rights, that everything was proven. But in a lot of those higher level cases, the state very well may have everything they need. And it's just making sure I hold my client's hand throughout the process and explain everything to them. And a lot of them, there's minimum mandatory sentences. So they're getting life regardless of what I do. And it's just making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted.
That has to be a wild feeling.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, they're not as common, but it is crazy to know that this client, and I think I feel the hardest part is seeing their families, and they're usually, it's harder for them to understand. I think a lot of people in those situations, they know what they did to get them there. They understand why they're there and that the rest of their life is going to be in prison. A lot of the times it's hardest for the families. And obviously, given the background, I know what it feels like to be in the family's shoes, granted different circumstances. But I think a lot of times that's the hardest part. And a lot of these people, if they even have family, I mean, a lot of clients we have, they're sentencing their trials. There's no one in the crowd for them. We're the only one showing up for them. And that's a little heartbreaking to see. I would like to think if I was ever accused of a crime, I'd have people that would show up for me. But it certainly makes you wonder, well, I'm not surprised they did what they did. They have no one
Right. Yeah. And that, I mean, we all know what a support system can do and a lack of one can cause, I guess.
Yeah.
So take me back to, I want to kind of jump back just a little bit to imposter syndrome. What was it like when you got to take on your first case? Were you thinking, here I am, I'm ready to go? Or was that an imposter syndrome moment?
I mean,
when you finally cleared the bar, you finally did. You got there.
It varies because obviously I was working in the field and I was working at my firm. So it was a lot of cases that I had already been working on, stuff like that. My first trials, it didn't even really feel that surreal. I think it was like you always have specific cases and trials that really stick out to you. But it certainly was surreal that I'm like, oh, my God, their lives are in my hands now. Like, I'm not just the one of I'll file the stuff, I'll mail the stuff. But like their life is in my hands. I'm the person that can affect so many of outcomes on their life. And like it's a pretty big responsibility to weigh. And burden to carry, but it certainly is scary sometimes, especially for the clients that you feel like shouldn't be there and that the system is treating them unfairly and you do everything you can and sometimes it's still not enough and you have to learn how to be okay with that.
Yeah, that's a trick. That's a trick.
Yes.
I'm sure a lot of people on the outside looking in on criminal justice, they tend to have the attitude that most people there are there for a reason. You know, they're guilty. They were in the wrong spot at the wrong time, whatever the case may be. How do you parse out not having that feeling when you know that? And I know I've kind of asked this question twice, but I'm really trying to get to the understanding where, or I'm trying to get wrap my head around how you get to the point where you can divorce whatever morality you have to, you know, you said you couldn't set it aside entirely. That's okay. I get that. But I mean, if you're dealing with one of these high level crimes, what is it that makes it so you want to try to keep saying, well, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. You know what I mean? What's the driving part behind that? And I know you do like some philanthropic work as well and donating your time as well. So maybe talk to me a little bit about that and how those feelings all kind of dovetail into your bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think the criminal justice system as a whole, a lot of it operates on the fact of they would rather an innocent person go to jail than let a guilty person free. I kind of operate on the opposite of that.
Okay.
I think for a lot of my clients that are genuinely guilty and have a history of committing crimes, it's only a matter of time before they do something that the state will have the evidence on and it will get them locked up for either a substantial period of time or potentially on what they did the rest of their life. For me, it is not worth the risk of an innocent person going through it. I think karma, I do believe in karma, and it always has a way of working out. And so if it, especially with the death penalty stuff, the amount of innocent people that they have sentenced on the death penalty and then after the fact tested DNA and found out that the person was innocent.
And right.
Like, that is too big of a risk and it's not worth it. And how do we say that we're any better than them if we can justify killing? Because in their mind, they could justify killing.
Right.
Allegedly. And so if we can punish someone for being able to justify ending someone else's life, how can we do the same to them and claim ourselves better?
Yeah, that is a hell of a paradox.
Yeah. So it goes full circle, and I think sometimes people are their own worst enemy, that if they're truly guilty, I think they'll end up caught one way or another, regardless of what I do. Even if I get a case dismissed, the likelihood of them coming back around and the state having then what they need is going to happen, but I don't like seeing innocent people go to jail or being punished unfairly, and I think oftentimes the system is just says, well, if you did something enough to get law enforcement's attention and get arrested, then it is what it is.
Right. It's a statistical inevitability, I suppose.
Yeah.
To some degree. I forgot what I was just going to ask you. Oh, you mentioned something that I actually have a personal interest in, and that's wrongful convictions.
Yeah.
it seems to be, Now, help me understand why all of a sudden this has become such a thing. Is it more that we've gotten better with the science of things and we can go back and look at cases differently? Or is it a matter that we're finding some fundamental errors in our ways of the past that we're trying to right? What is going on that all these wrongful convictions seem to have happened and now we're starting to be more attuned to uncovering them?
I think it's honestly... it's always happened. I think it's just now with social media and internets that it's more accessible to find out that it happened and for us to learn about them, that obviously the state's not going to be advertising when they wrongfully arrested someone, things like that. But certainly the technology with DNA testing has come a long way. I think that's usually statistically the most common reason why people's convictions can be overturned, but a lot of it is from eyewitness testimony and inmates in jail. We always have to have the discussions with clients about having what we call discovery. That's all the evidence, the police reports, stuff like that, with them at jail, because people find it, and to get better sentences for themselves, they'll read it and then say, "Oh yeah, yeah, he confessed this all to me. I'll testify in his trial if you knock this off my sentence."
Of course.
And there's a lot of reasons why even eyewitness testimony can be unreliable, and people's memories are not always the most consistent, and they can be subject to change. And so there's a lot of factors that go into it. But I think with social media and the news and the internet, it's just easier to be able to access the information and see how much it's really been happening, but it's always been going on, and it unfortunately probably always will.
Do you think that that is also a statistical inevitability, or is accounted for mainly by statistical inevitability, or this is just some kind of bias that's just getting unearthed now?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, unfortunately, I see it in my practice every day that I have evidence I can explain to a prosecutor until I'm blue in the face why this person is innocent and why they should just dismiss the case, and they'll refuse to do so. And they'll say, "Well, I'll leave it in the eyes of a jury. I'll let a jury decide. I don't want that weight." And with the lawsuits and stuff like that nowadays, everyone certainly rushes to suing someone if they can. And so it does make people a little bit more hesitant to the news, things like that. I mean, we see it all the time when someone goes out and harms another person, and the first thing they look is, "Oh, well, they had criminal history, and that judge let them off on probation, and they let them out into the streets, and look, then they went and did this crime." And so I think it's kind of full circle, and so that mentality is oftentimes in the back of the head for a lot of judges and prosecutors, and so they're just like, "Well, they must have done something to get in the system, so we got to figure it out." And they're not as quick to just let someone go free.
What do you think, if anything, is reasonable counterpoint to that attitude? Because that attitude seems very well-founded. It seems logical.
Honestly, and I think some judges and prosecutors would probably hate me for saying this, but getting rid of absolute immunity, whether that be for law enforcement or prosecutors, stuff like that. I think if people had the ability to be held more accountable, there are unfortunately shady things that happen. Evidence that is withheld from their defense attorneys, things that aren't turned over,
right?
Wrongful testimony. And so I think if there was a way to start holding people more accountable, they would start hopefully doing more of the right things. And not knowing, well, whatever I do, it doesn't really matter. No one's going to come after me for it.
Very interesting. Yeah, I suppose. I guess the nature of wrongful convictions would have to somewhat be rooted in the fact that there's no check and balance to start it if all of the pieces of the puzzle are in cahoots.
Yeah. And, I mean, a lot of police departments, stuff like that, they get their funding based on the amount of arrests they have. They get rewarded. They get accolades for how many arrests. And so it's a lot of times a numbers game. And one of my business partners used to be a prosecutor. And so it's certainly interesting hearing from his side kind of the things that they were taught at the prosecutor's office and the mindsets they had on approaching things that I don't know if I'm still relatively new. Obviously, I haven't been practicing for 20, 30 years like some people, but
right.
I'd still like to believe that we can be better and there's always room for improvement. But
do you think there's maybe what do you think is the working part of it that makes it so that can't happen? Because, I mean, you fundamentally have a prosecutor's office with, you know, everybody on the side of wanting to convict this person all on one side and you all on the other. You're diametrically opposed just by the nature of it. And regardless of the facts, one person still has a job to put somebody away or punish somebody, and one person still has a job at bare minimum to mitigate the punishment. How do you think you can try to reconcile some of those things, like you were saying, when you're just so diametrically opposed?
People that care on both sides.
No money in caring.
It's hard because obviously there are so many attorneys out there. But I do like to think the younger generations are coming in and they are a bit more aggressive about wanting things to be different, and aren't necessary. We're not as afraid to say when it should be different, but it always comes down to people caring. And at the end of the day, when I was first looking at my career, obviously I've always said I wanted to be a criminal defense attorney, but I think there's something to be said that I've considered working as a prosecutor sometimes, because I think people that can see both sides of it and are open to reason and open to explanations and are just willing to listen. I mean, there's plenty of prosecutors where I may not fully agree with them, but they will listen to me and they will give me the opportunity to present my case and to explain why. And I've thankfully have really good relationships with a lot of them. And luckily the criminal defense bar overall is really good about it in comparison to civil, that we have good relationships with one another. And obviously we have a lot of cases. It's not just one case. And so trying to just explain things to them. And as long as someone's willing to listen, I mean, people certainly in politics nowadays, you grow up. Your opinions change. Anyone should be open to changing their opinion if they're provided enough information. It's okay to say, yeah, I don't know enough about that. Tell me more, and being open to change your position then. And luckily, a lot of prosecutors I work with are good about that. As long as they give me an open ear, bureaucratically, whether or not they can do what I'm asking them to, no, but a lot of them will try, and that counts for something.
Yeah, that amen to that. Yeah. So you did mention the younger attorneys. You did start your career relatively young comparatively, yeah?
Yes. Like I said, became a named partner at, I was 28, which at that point, I mean, I'm still learning so many things. I just turned 30 this year, and I feel like I have a million things left to learn.
That's the fun part, though.
It's crazy being responsible for staff that are only a few years younger than me, and I have to be their boss. But I think with technology and stuff like that, I'd like to think that the generations are very empathetic, the younger ones of them coming in, and they're more open-minded, certainly. And it's been hard. I have certainly, especially varying on counties, plenty of older male attorneys that like to come up to me like, oh, are you the court reporter? Are you a defendant? And I'm like, no, I'm the attorney. Thank you.
Oh,
that they forget that we're still out here. We're still doing things. And like to, it's inevitable. I think it's always going to exist to an extent, but I think more and more so now. I mean, there is a pretty big young generation entering the legal field now that we see it in the courtrooms, that there are a lot of individuals probably in their like 50s to 70s age range of attorneys. And then there's probably some in their late 20s to 30s, and there's a big gap. But I think we're in the next few years, we're going to be looking at a big shift once the older generations start retiring, and it's a lot younger attorneys with different life experiences coming in.
Right. Are there any things other than empathy that you would say contribute to that?
I mean, I think that's the biggest one. And just, I mean, I think imposter syndrome can be a good thing. I've certainly been able to use it to my benefit because, one, I'm a lawyer. I know all the ways people can screw up, so it makes you a little bit paranoid. and I do have anxiety naturally anyways, but if you never fully feel like you're like, oh, should I be here? Am I doing everything I can? You make sure that you're doing the work to be there. I think I certainly earned the position I've been given, but at the same time, I'm going to make sure that I continue to deserve it. And so whenever you question that, I get a little bit more worried by the people that have never had the imposter syndrome because they tend to not be very humble or open to other perspectives. Whereas I think if you have enough insight and you're introspective enough to be able to question like, hey, am I doing everything I can? Do I deserve this? All those things, all those questions that you constantly ask yourself in those situations, I think it makes you more thorough and makes you more passionate about what you're doing.
Right. Yeah, that's a powerful thing as well. I mean, you have to be able to draw on something. How much of your time coming up to those points would you say you had to spend outside your comfort zone to be able to tell yourself when you got there those things?
So much. I'm of the firm believer you don't grow when you're comfortable. If you're not doing things that scare the shit out of you, then you're not doing much.
Right.
But there's a lot of growth. And part of with our career and stuff like that is you always have to be willing to learn to grow. But a lot of it's scary. There's, especially with criminal defense, there's high stakes and you don't want to screw up. You don't want to be the reason why someone that shouldn't have gone to jail goes to jail. But as long as you do everything in your power, I can't change the facts of what
have you ever had to have that feeling?
Yes. I had a client that, I mean, were they fully innocent? Who knows? I don't think anyone fully knows, but they got a DUI for driving on prescription medication. And it was medication that they had been on for like 20 years. They were more than well acquainted with the effects of it. At that point, I don't even think it was really doing anything for them.
Yeah, 20 years is a long time.
Yes. And we went through the first trial. I mean, I was adamant that they weren't impaired. I mean, when you watch the body-worn camera, stuff like that, I mean, it was an older gentleman and yeah, he's not going to do great on field sobriety exercises. He's fully disabled. He can hardly walk normally as it is. It doesn't mean someone's impaired.
Right.
But we went through a trial the first time and got a split jury. Half of them couldn't decide. And so we go through trial a second time. And unfortunately, at the second trial, there's a lot of factors that goes into a trial and someone's financial ability. And at that time, his doctors cost so much money to have them testify at the trials that we couldn't call them again. He just didn't have the money to be able to pay all of them to be able to appear and testify on his behalf.
Right.
And I think overall, unfortunately, it's something I have to explain to a lot of clients that jurors don't understand how to handle disabilities or medical issues. They're not doctors. They don't know what to do with that. And I think a lot of times people default to, well, I'm better safe than sorry. We're better off finding them guilty, which if I was a juror, I'd be the opposite. But I genuinely don't believe he was guilty. But unfortunately, at the second trial, he was found guilty. And ahead of time, I had discussions with the jail, stuff like that, of saying, hey, worst case scenario, if this person goes into jail, are you going to give him his medication? Are you going to do this stuff? And they're like, no. We're not giving someone these types of medication that's in custody. And I felt that it was life or death for him if he went into custody because he had been on these medications for 20 years.
Right.
If he just stops cold turkey, his body's going to go into failure. And so explaining that at sentencing to the judge, but unfortunately he had prior criminal history from 15 years ago, and they really stuck on that and gave him the maximum amount of sentence they could for it in jail. And I'm like, Your Honor, like, it's going to kill him. And they're just like, we'll see. We'll find out. Let me know what happens. And within a week, he started suffering from seizures. So thankfully, he's still okay. But I remember walking out of when he was sentenced, and it was everything to not cry getting out of the courtroom, but just having, I will admit that I had a panic attack in the bathroom outside of it, just on the what if he died while in custody? Is that justice? And that case was really hard to deal with being an attorney and continue being an attorney when I certainly felt that it wasn't warranted for the situation. Luckily, he's able to get through, but unfortunately, at the end of the day, sometimes a lot of the evidentiary issues, it comes down to the jury as to whether or not they believe, and you have six people that differ in life experiences that they choose guilty or not guilty for the strangest of reasons sometimes.
You could never, ever account for in a million lifetimes.
No, they've done, and it's something I have to explain to clients, like they've done studies of jurors after trials and been like, hey, why did you find guilty or not guilty? And they're like, yeah, I really didn't like his defense attorney, or I didn't like the shoes they were wearing, or I didn't like the way they said that. They were seemed really loud. It just seems like the most asinine reasons why they would make determinations and not based on the law or the evidence presented. And they take into account their own personal experiences, which we give them jury instructions. We tell them certain things they should take into account. But at the end of the day, they're human, and we can never get rid of someone's full life experiences, and people always come in with biases, and so it's unpredictable.
Do you think that there's an alternative to the jury trial? Do you think that we'll see a time where we're going to get AI that doesn't have to worry about people's shoes?
Probably not. I mean, there is technically an alternative, which is a non-jury trial, and it's in front of the judge, but I don't really know that you're much better off at that point.
I was going to say that's kind of six, one, half dozen of the other for some people, yeah?
Yeah, at least with the jurors, all six of them, or 12, depending on what level of crime it is, they all have to agree, whereas with the judge, you're only convincing one person.
Right.
But, I mean, there's benefits and cons for both of them, but I don't trust AI.
Yeah, we're at a burgeoning level. That's the only reason I said that is because it's like, you know, what immediately could be non-biased and just strictly referencing all facts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I don't think I've ever had anyone ask me that, but I mean, I'd be curious to see it, but I don't know. It's crazy to think that it could even be a possibility. It's crazy to see the things that AI does nowadays.
Well, because inherently, for want of a better way of putting it, wrongful incarcerations or penalties that don't fit the crime, these are all attributed ultimately to human error, pilot error, right? I mean, it's, you know, whether or not you followed the mandate that mandate came down from a bunch of people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't arbitrary. It wasn't, none of the things that you operate under were arbitrarily come to by a truly objective source. The game was all set up by people who play the game.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't realize how much politics goes into the laws and how many, I mean, like weed is a good example of it. I think one of the biggest companies and people backing marijuana not being legalized oftentimes is alcohol and tobacco companies.
Right.
And why? Because it hurts their bottom line and their financial interests. And a lot of times, unfortunately, our laws are based on industries like that have the financial backing to lobby for these laws that they're not always rooted in reality or what the people want, which unfortunately I think we're seeing a lot of that currently.
Yeah, we're definitely in a flux spot of that, I would say. I think we're all feeling that from varying sides.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to ask you one tough one, and then we can get you out of here on something easier. One moderately tough one.
Okay,
before you said when this gentleman with the case that threw you, the first time you had the split jury and then the second time you got found guilty, what I'm curious about is, or got punished to the highest extent, what I'm curious about is what your mental process is after round one and before round two. Was that the first time that had happened to you?
That was my first mistrial. On the like principal level, I feel like if you get a mistrial, it should automatically been thrown out. It shouldn't be, hey, you get to go retry this again. Like, out of principle, if half of the jurors could not decide and none of them could agree, I feel like by default, that should just be a not guilty. Unfortunately, that's not what the law states, but a lot of it was trying, obviously, there were jurors that found him guilty. There was other jurors that didn't agree. And so that specific client had been willing to take a plea. We were just looking for no incarceration. And after the mistrial, the state finally was willing to agree to a non-jail sentence that would have just been probation and completing the normal statutory DUI conditions. And the judge actually wouldn't take it. She said she wasn't going to agree to a non-jail offer, and so we were forced into going to trial again. And so it's just, I think there's so many factors in that that I feel we're just one after another that I'm like, really? We're just blow after blow.
So how do you contain your mental state and stay focused when that kind of, you get those kind of curveballs? Because I imagine that wasn't your last curveball.
No, I mean, unfortunately, I kind of wish I had grown up doing sports. I grew up dancing, and I wish I had done sports to get more acclimated to losing because unfortunately, I mean, I think we're a great team. We do great work. But sometimes the law is just not on your side, or even when the law is on your side, sometimes no matter what you do, a judge just won't agree with you. And you have to get up and still keep going and still keep doing your job because there's going to be another case. Unfortunately, it's Florida. Florida man is alive and well.
Oh, yes.
We also have the come on vacation leave on probation. So the crimes are never.
I've never heard that one. That's a good one.
Yes. People are never going to stop committing crimes. And so.
In Florida.
Yes. Well, and everywhere.
No, I know.
But especially in Florida, people get wild down here. And so it's unfortunately, it's just I don't have any other choice but to keep going on and hope that it doesn't happen again and learn from it. And see what we can do better next time, or hope that the judge or the prosecutor learned something from that experience. But there's unfortunately not a full great answer.
That actually led me to one other question I want to ask you.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile, or how do you feel about times in your process, like when this judge tells you, no, they're not going to accept a no jail proposition, when there are people in this A to B that you're going to that have unilateral power to throw the monkey wrench or change things? How do you feel about the people in the criminal justice system that have unilateral power?
I'm not a fan, which is made by me. I was like, one day it'd be great to be a judge and they're going to go back and be like, look at this interview.
Yeah.
No, but it's just hard. I think a lot of it comes down with, once a judge is elected, I mean, it's not very frequent that a judge loses their seat when it comes time for re-elections. I think most voters that are not attorneys or that have not had personal experiences with the judges just assume, well, if they're on the bench, they must be doing a good enough job. We'll just keep them on. And I don't think our current election system, people really dive in deep enough to looking in to see these judges and what kind of decisions they're making and if they're more biased towards one side or not. They're supposed to be fair and impartial, but at the end of the day,
we're humans.
And I've certainly seen a lot of different things from a lot of judges, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they deserve to lose their position. But I think there needs to be better oversight on a lot of it and better review. Obviously, there's an appeal process, but that takes time and money. And sometimes a lot of people just don't have that opportunity.
I was going to say that's more an opportunity for the train to go off the tracks than make it to the station.
Yeah. Well, and like in that case, I immediately filed an appeal and we got a public defender working on it. But at that time, I mean, the appellate process takes a long time and it's still pending and he's out of jail now. So at
good
that
Lord.
Point, what's the benefit? I mean, they could literally say, you know what, this was a wrongful conviction. There's no way a jury could have found guilt. We're overturning that. But what good does it do when he already served his sentence? We can't go back and give him that time back. And so it's a hard, there's not really any great systems in place for it.
So is there some kind of countermeasure to that? I mean, everybody here, oh, a person sues for wrongful conviction and is a millionaire for the rest of their life. That doesn't happen to everybody, I gather.
I don't think there should be immunity, again, for law enforcement or even prosecutors or judges. I think there is a lot of things that go on behind closed doors that are not the most ethical, and there needs to be an ability. Unfortunately, people give lawyers a bad rap and say we're sue happy and we'll sue over the drop of a dime. But in some ways, it exists for a reason, and it does encourage better behavior on a lot of things. And so there's not a great answer. And I think if we had an answer to it, hopefully we wouldn't be having this problem anymore. But I think it takes a lot of oversight and people being held accountable and people bringing it to light when there's something that's wrong. And I think having good people in those positions of law enforcement, of prosecutors, obviously it's a hard job. It's not for the faint of heart, and they certainly a lot of times are underpaid and understaffed, but I think there's a lot of factors that go into it, and there may not be a good answer anytime
soon. So ultimately, there's a huge underpinning of the circle of life of accountability. The criminal, everybody, we all need to be more accountable in the process. Yes. So that kind of dovetails me into your fun one. And it's your fun one because there's no wrong answer, no right answer. You say whatever you want. Yeah. If you could wave a wand and change one or two things about the criminal justice system that you exist in that you think would benefit you, your clients, everybody across the board, whatever the case may be, if you could flip a switch, wave a wand, what's one of the things you would change?
Man, terrible timing for this one to come through, but marijuana legalization. I grew up in Colorado, so I guess I'm a little biased on that front that I've seen what it can do, but I see how many cases arise out of the smell of weed. Like, what, people stop carrying weed in your cars. Like, it's crazy how many cases arise just from the smell, but I think in the long run, it would generate money for our economy. I think it's unfair to be still putting people in jail and prisons for something that serves a medical purpose. And in the grand scheme of things, it's not when there's fentanyl on the streets. Is weed really our biggest concern?
Yeah, true that.
And I think, obviously, I don't condone theft, things like that. But when it comes down to someone's taking food at a grocery store, I mean, there should be certain things in place that are a bit more understanding for it. But I think overall diversion programs are good, but that help people avoid convictions. But I don't know. There's a lot of crimes exist for a reason. There's one, it's illegal to take a shopping cart off a premises.
This I know from my time living in LA.
I know. Unfortunately, the majority of people that are prosecuted for that are homeless people, but I did represent a lady for free one time because she sent me a letter and she's like, I was arrested for having a shopping cart. And so I was like, this is ridiculous. So I think some of the stuff like that, obviously there, it's crazy how many laws are in Florida that are just not enforced anymore, but still technically illegal, like having your horses at certain times. And I think having sex in any position other than missionary is actually illegal in the state of Florida.
Dang.
Yeah, obviously no one's enforcing that.
I thought we were the most America state. What happened?
I know. I don't know how anyone, I don't even know how they enforce that in the first place, if they ever did or who created
that. That was some kind of scare
that
tactic.
Yes, but obviously there's a lot of weird laws out there and most of them just aren't enforced, but it's more work to get them repealed and changed than just not enforce them anymore. But it's crazy how many are out there that people just
nuts
don't know.
It's easier to leave it than press a delete key.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
and I obviously
insane.
There's more that needs to go into that. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming down. I really appreciate your time. And boy, I would love to do this again because there's a lot I'd like to continue to pick your brain about.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming. We're really grateful for you sharing, and you're K the family now. So anything you got, you're always welcome to come here.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.
It was such a pleasure.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.